So we've just had the festival of Manjushri Bodhisattva, and I wanted to talk a little bit about Manjushri and the practice of wisdom as it can be applied in our daily life. Before I get into talking about Manjushri, I want to present an idea that I think is really important. In terms of understanding practice and in terms of understanding the bodhisattvas and the characteristics of Buddha nature, compassion, love, and wisdom, there's a great line in the festival, in the litany of Manjushri Bodhisattva, where he's asking the Buddha, how do I engender bodhicitta? How do I engender this aspiration to become a Buddha? How do I really put that into practice? And the Buddha says, all dharmas accord with conditions, with causes and conditions. All dharmas accord with causes and conditions. And the term dharmas that he's using there is the small d dharma, and that means things. All kind of objects, things, people, beings, all of the kind of things in the world. Everything accords with causes and conditions. There's a saying that Rinpoche Master Ji used to use, and I think it's a common one in the Zen world. We can't jump beyond the great round mirror. And this goes to that same idea. The great round mirror is what Yamantaka, the great Yamantaka, the Lord of the Dead, is holding up in the wheel of, in the mandala of the wheel of the life. And he's holding up a great mirror, and all of life is reflected in that mirror. All of the kind of ins and outs of our ups and downs of our karma are reflected in that great mirror. And to try to jump beyond that is to try to get away from the causes and conditions. So what the Buddha is talking about when he's talking to Manjushri as the king is saying, if you want to become a Buddha, you have to go through the process of becoming a Buddha. You have to put the causes and conditions into place to become a Buddha. You have to do what it takes. You have to actually do what it takes to become a Buddha. You have to cultivate all the virtues. You have to eliminate evil ways from your mind. You have to meditate and train. And this is really, it's a really important thing. We see compassion, love, and wisdom, and we think, I want that. I want wisdom. And so then we say, okay, I'm going to go for it. I've got wisdom. And we hear the Buddhas and ancestors telling us, you do have wisdom. You hear people like me saying, you've got wisdom, use it. But we're also saying, you have to use that wisdom in accord with causes and conditions. And you have to uncover that wisdom by penetrating causes and conditions. We can't jump beyond the great round mirror. Nothing comes to us automatically just because we want it. So Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, also called Beautiful Lord, sits there on his beast. Wisdom is one of three characteristics of Buddha nature that we talk about. I'm sure there are others, but these are the three primary characteristics: compassion, love, and wisdom. And those three characteristics, while we emphasize one or more of them at various times in our training, they're never separate from each other. They're aspects of Buddha nature. They're never separate from each other. When we start to practice, and I believe that the way that I see it, every religion has these three characteristics, these three aspects of reality embodied in their teaching: compassion, love, and wisdom. Every religious system has some way of expressing those three characteristics. When we start practicing Soto Zen, we're given the means to practice those three things when we're given our meditation instruction, when we're given the precepts, and when we're given the scripture of great wisdom. meditation is compassion, the precepts are love, and the scripture of great wisdom is wisdom. So these three characteristics, right from the beginning, were given. Right from the beginning, were said, here is what it is. Here is all of it, in a way. Precepts, meditation, scripture, great wisdom. The Buddha Dharma, the three treasures, embody these three characteristics. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Buddha is wisdom. Dharma is love again. Sangha is compassion. It's very important. The Sangha is very important in terms of practicing and understanding the Dharma. It embodies compassion. In the scripture of great wisdom, compassion is the source of wisdom. The scripture of great wisdom is enunciated by Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. This is no accident. Compassion is the source of wisdom. Where wisdom comes from, and always needs to be rooted in and come back to. So we set off to train. We think, I want compassion, I want love, I want wisdom. I want to embody these things in my life. And this is the situation which Manjushri finds himself when he goes to the Buddha. I want to embody these things to the highest extent. I want to become a Buddha. I want to give expression to Buddha nature. How do I do that? And the Buddha says, accord with causes and conditions. Proceed in accordance with causes and conditions. There are a lot of different ways of talking about wisdom in terms of spiritual practice. I mean, there's the wisdom of balancing your checkbook. And believe me, balancing your checkbook is an expression of wisdom. It's just practical, good sense. It's wise. And then there is all the way up to, well, through the wisdom of the four wisdoms, as Dogen talks about in the Shishobi. The four wisdoms are exemplified with Bodhisattva virtues. They are charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy. Those don't sound like wisdom. You know, wisdom got the sword, but charity, tenderness, benevolence, sympathy. Interesting. Wisdom has that soft heart in this way of looking at it. All the way then through up to the scripture of great wisdom. The penetration into the reality of life, the very nature of life. Form is all pure, pure is all form. What does that all mean? How do we understand that? So wisdom has different ways of, we have different ways of talking about wisdom within the Dharma. Sometimes the experience of enlightenment, Kensho, Satori, is talked about as if it were the acme of perfection of wisdom, the knowing of wisdom within your own heart and mind, the knowing of emptiness within your own heart and mind in a profound way. And I think this is probably true. I have no argument with that. If we want to have that experience, people then set out to say, okay, I'm going to have this experience. I'm going to awaken to the truth. I'm going to get enlightened. You know, we were talking one day about how, and I think they still have these, you have enlightenment intensive retreats. Go to the retreat, get an awakening within 3 or 4 days, you know, pay your $5,000, get an awakening, and there you go, your wisdom, you're enlightened, okay? And then you go home and you have to deal with the dog. Or as a little inside joke. The thing that I have seen so often, there was an interesting thing that happened with a teacher that I know of who had just gotten done with a series of formal sanzens, formal dialogues with lay trainees who had come for a retreat. And he was saying, with the kind of this little glow, like, here's something special for you all. He was saying that he was talking to a fellow who said to him, it's very hard, once you've let go of self, it's very hard to recreate the self. And the teacher was saying, yeah, isn't that so? Once you've let go of self, it's so hard to recreate the self. Isn't that so? And I'm thinking, when I heard this, I'm thinking, not to say that I'm really all that great myself, but thinking, that's kind of interesting. Isn't that interesting? And then, as the years go on after this, I see both of those people recreate the self in rather spectacular ways. And I think, no, the reality of it is, even once you have awakened to the truth, once you have let go of self, it is frighteningly easy to recreate the self. Frighteningly easy. To take a position, begin to defend it, and make a self for yourself. And this is why I'm talking about, while I'm talking about wisdom, I'm talking about all three aspects, compassion, love, and wisdom. Because they cannot be separated, much though we would like them to be. There is within each of us, I think, quite a lot of pain and suffering. And it is a source of great grief and sadness for me to come to see that in myself and to see it in others. We know that this is there, and the path of training leads right into it. And we don't really want to go into it. We want to leap beyond it and go to wisdom, where we feel there will be a safety, where we feel there will be where we feel we won't make mistakes again. It is deeply important that we have deep compassion for ourselves and recognize that while that is a temptation, it is not reflective of the reality of life, where the reality of life says we cannot leap beyond the great round mirror. We have to proceed according to causes and conditions. And our training out of compassion, where we start in compassion, we start with meditation, we start with the precepts, we start with study of the scriptures. We start in our training with the recognition that we are human beings and we have ignorance. We do not see what we don't know. We do not see what we, in a sense, need to know. We look within ourselves, we do the best that we can, but we actually don't know everything. And the reality of life is that means there's going to be suffering. We're going to make mistakes. Even the Buddha, the more I go along, the more impressed I am with the Buddha. not because of all the things that he said, but just as a human being, having to live out his life, and how, I mean, for me, I started practicing, I really just wanted to learn how to help people and not hurt them. And, you know, this is what I dedicated my life to. And I know that the Buddha was, in a sense, the same. So he gets there, he's the Buddha, he knows he's the Buddha, he's enlightened, and yet he still makes mistakes. How must that have felt for him? You know, this thing that just kind of boggles my mind, he had like 40 disciples who he said, okay, go and contemplate the loathsomeness of the body. I've told you this all before. But it just kind of stands out as one of these kind of potent kind of teachings of the Buddha's life. He says to these 40 disciples, okay, and this is the standard thing, his usual kind of teaching for people, go and contemplate the loathsomeness of the body. You know, look at, we're trying to learn how to detach ourselves from our body, look at, you know, the pus and all the stuff that goes on in the body, what is that really like? And the people say, these monks nod and say, okay, we'll do that, and they go off and train together. And they start thinking to themselves, boy, these bodies are really bad. They're awful. Look at how bad these bodies are. Look how loathsome these bodies are. We should kill ourselves. And they do. I mean, what were they thinking? Of course, it's their responsibility. They've made the mistake. They've misinterpreted things. But you're the Buddha, and you've given people this instruction, and they have misunderstood and misused it. And you're supposed to be the Buddha, the one who knows everything. How must that have felt for him? Even the Buddha, who was a human being, had to undergo this situation in which he did not know everything. He did not have that all-pervasive knowledge of things. He was not a god. He was always a human being. He always had the limitations of a human being. This is where we all are, where we all start from. Where we start from is having a lot more ignorance than the Buddha, I kind of have to admit. He was pretty wise. He was pretty insightful. He knew what was going on. I trust him, even though I can see that he was a human being. Reverend Messer Rokuzan mentioned this morning a deeply important characteristic of the statue of Manjushri. Manjushri sits on the beast. And I've seen some really amazing, you know, kind of artistic, you know, kind of amazing statues of Manjushri. In the really good statues of Manjushri, Manjushri is not just sitting on top of the beast, he's actually sort of kind of one with the beast. And that is how we are training ourselves. That is what is being pointed to is Manjushri, in that statue, Manjushri as the Bodhisattva, is a person who has gone through all of the causes and conditions to give expression to deepest wisdom of the heart. He's gone through all of the training to become Manjushri, the celestial Bodhisattva, the example. It is said, actually, that Manjushri, as is true with Avalokiteshvara and Samantabhadra, are actually Buddhas in their own right. In our litany of Manjushri Bodhisattva, it says that Manjushri is the ninth predecessor to the Buddha. That means he was the Buddha nine times, you know, nine places before Shakyamuni. And yet, here he is, he's manifest as a Bodhisattva to help Shakyamuni Buddha in this world. So Manjushri is deeply wise. He is the embodiment of the fulfillment of the practice toward enlightenment. And he sits at one with the beast of self. As, you know, according to the dependent origination, what the Buddha taught, as I understand it, as long as we're human beings, we're going to have a self. We're not always going to be bound by the self, but we're always going to have a self. It's like having a shadow. If you have a physical body in this world, you will have a shadow. You can't get rid of it. If you try to destroy the shadow, it's futile, because in a way the shadow is completely ephemeral. And that is how the self is. The only way you can destroy the shadow is to destroy your body, to vaporize your body. The only way that you can get rid of a self is to completely dissolve the five constituent parts that make up a human being: form, sensation, thought, activity, and consciousness. As long as we're human beings, we will have a self. As long as we're human beings, we will not be able to see everything completely. So what Manjushri is pointing toward is not how to destroy the self, but how to learn how to let it go. How to learn how to let go of it. Now, there's a really important thing Reverend Master Rokuzan and I were talking about the other day, about the idea of letting go. And I've done this before. It doesn't work so well with this chair, but it's... The difference between letting go and holding on is like this. Actually, I'm going to use this little chair over here.
Work there. So, I have this chair. I like to sit in it. It helps me. I'm comfortable in it. It's got nice arms on it. If I'm holding onto this chair, then that's okay if I'm sitting in it. I can hold on to it. It doesn't get in my way. Kind of puts a little tension in my hands and all that stuff. But in the short run, it's okay. But when I decide I want to get up and walk around, then and I'm holding onto the chair, well, it kind of gets in my way. I'm going to whack people with it. Okay? But if I'm not letting go, if I'm letting go of the chair, I can stand up and walk around without it. I don't need the chair. But I can make use of the chair. I can sit in it again if I want to. I'm not bound by the chair. And that's what we mean by letting go. We're not pushing anything away. We're not getting rid of anything. We're just letting it go. So that we can make use of it when we need to, but not let it obstruct us when we don't need to make use of it. We can get up and walk away from it if we need to. This is what we mean by letting go of the self. So that at some point, and at various points, you know, like our shadow, you might be in a dark room and you don't have a shadow then. Okay? Well, at some points in training, the self disappears. And boy, that's glorious. That's pretty nice. But it always comes back. The light always comes back on. As long as we're alive, the self will always be there. We just need to not be fooled by it. We need to be able to understand what it is. In order to not be fooled by it, we actually have to allow ourselves to be in the place where we get fooled by it and to go through that place. So let me say that again. This is how compassion works. We were talking earlier about my 20-year wretched. And quite honestly, you know, it's been really kind of one of the worst 3 months periods in my life lately, but there it is. And if it were to arise again in a similar way, I think I would be able to handle it better. I think I would have learned something from it and know something more about myself and will be able to value the experience in the future, and it will inform and help me. But if I were, but I know for myself that I can't ever promise that I will never make those kinds of mistakes again. And that it's likely that on another level this will arise again and I will go through it and not see something about myself and make mistakes and hurt myself and hurt others. I really hate that situation. I really don't like it. I would do anything if I could trade it in and have something else, but I can't. Compassion, then, out of compassion, out of my wish to undo suffering, my wish to find the deep truth of life, I go forward knowing that I'm going to make mistakes. This is compassion. This is being willing to just go forward and continue to try. And part of that compassion is understanding that this is also part of wisdom. Accepting that I'm ignorance and the consequence of my ignorance. One of the biggest obstacles to wisdom and compassion is pride, quite honestly. There are a lot of different reasons that we have pride. I'm not trying to belittle it, because I understand why it comes about. But we have to be honest and say, pride is a big obstacle to wisdom, to the development of wisdom. Because the first step of the development of wisdom is admitting that we are ignorant and don't know. And it is out of pride that we find it very difficult to make that admission.
The Buddha said that if you want to have the consequence of being knowledgeable and wise, you should go and ask someone about things. Which is basically sort of saying, okay, I admit I don't know something, I'm going to go learn about it. Whoever we are, wherever we are along the path, that's where wisdom always begins. Being able to sit still in the place where we don't know. And again, that is deeply, in a way, frightening. Because admitting that we don't know means admitting that we can create suffering for ourselves and for others. Because we don't know. Happily, we have the Buddha Dharma. And we can guide ourselves based on the Buddha Dharma. This is what the love aspect of the precept means. Out of love for beings, the Buddha said, okay, well, here's some guidelines for how to proceed in life. Here's some things that you can read about and study, and they will inform your experience of life. They won't be the way, when you study these things, they won't be a guarantee, because you will always have your perspective. But they will help you to refine your experience of life. This is, again, the love of Buddha nature, of the Buddhas and ancestors. And part of studying the precepts and studying the Dharma and studying the sayings and teachings of teachers is recognizing that we may be misinterpreting what they're saying. Now, there's a sobering thought. I can read the Dharma and think, wow, this is great. I think it means X, Y, and Z in my own mind. And go forth and then find ourselves creating a lot of suffering based on our understanding of what the Dharma was. Because we have to be able to recognize that we have the possibility of misinterpreting what's being said. It's not that we always will, or that we should doubt ourselves. We just have to have the humility, really, to recognize that that's a possibility. And again, this is why, to me, the Sangha is part of compassion, is an expression of compassion. The Sangha is always going to be, well, I don't know about always. The Sangha always seems to me to be a bit of a pain in the neck, as I've said before. But the function of the Sangha is to help us to understand more clearly and to understand more deeply. That's the compassion of the Sangha. And so part of what happens is that we encounter difficulty with the Sangha. We encounter difficulty in our relations with other people. And imagine for a moment that you, although you've been practicing the Dharma for a while, and although you have a pretty reasonable understanding of how it works, but imagine for a moment that you have a little bit of distortion about some aspect of the Dharma. And you get into a situation where you have a conflict with someone else in the Sangha, and they either have a clear view of what's going on, or they have a little bit of distortion themselves about that aspect of life, that aspect of practice. And so you have a conflict, you know, you kind of butt heads with each other. Well, what do you do? How do you handle that situation? You know, you could just kind of get mad and say, the Sangha doesn't know anything, I'm going to stomp off and leave it behind. Because there's a conflict. But you could also say, I don't know anything, I'm dumb, there must be right, and so I'm just going to ignore myself. Well, that doesn't really work either. The process that we go through is to see that there's conflict arising, see that there's suffering arising, see that there's difficulty arising. And then we take what we do know of the Dharma and apply it to our lives and to the situation. In other words, we try to go more deeply into what's true and try to be willing to see where we might be distorted and where they might be distorted and begin to convert that distortion. This is how compassion works, that willingness to just keep trying with one another and to keep trying with the Dharma, to keep trying with the practice, to go more deeply, to look and see, what is really true here? How can I really understand this? And this is how we put the causes and conditions into place for coming to understanding clearly what wisdom is in the deepest sense. And how we come to understand how wisdom can really apply to every element of our life and how we can allow it to permeate every element of our life. And as is true with wisdom, so is also true with compassion and love. They're never separate. So Manjushri sits on his beast. He is completely one with his self. And the process that I'm describing, say with the conflict within the Sangha, is the process by which we come to be completely one with ourself, where we're no longer saying, I must be right and they must be wrong, therefore creating a self which I'm actually at tension with, or I must be wrong and they must be right, therefore creating a self which I'm in tension with, but actually seeing where my wisdom is and coming to be at one with my own self, and in the same process becoming one with all things. There's a line from Dogen where he says, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with the true nature of reality. We go into whatever pain and suffering that lives in our heart. We go into that and we begin to let it go and convert it and understand it. We follow that thread. We pull it out of ourselves. And in the process, we're studying ourselves and in studying ourselves, coming to see, studying ourselves being sitting still right in the place where self is arising and being willing to let it go more and more deeply. By sitting still in that place where suffering and pain is, we begin to let go of suffering and pain, and we find that deeper self. That's how we become one with self. That's how we begin to embody what Manjushri is embodying. We become one with it, and we can just, in a sense, forget about it. Because it is no longer in conflict with us. We are no longer trying to avoid it. We're no longer fooled by it. And in that regard, we forget about it. And then can just live. There's a line in the chapter, in River Master Jiyu's chapter about the heart of Manjushri, where she says, when I first asked my former master how to go about my studies, he told me quite simply, expect nothing, seek nothing, just live. This, to someone who had traveled around the world in order to study, did not seem at the time an adequate answer. Yet he spoke nothing more than the literal truth. It is, again, we find ourselves in a situation where we would just really love to be able to just stop creating suffering for ourselves and others. We just so want to do that. And yet, when we come to the Buddha Dharma, the Buddha Dharma is saying, well, yeah, I can appreciate that. Here's the way to do that. Just go about your life. Begin to meditate, begin to keep the precepts, begin to study the scriptures, the scripture of great wisdom. Apply the teaching in your daily life. This is how we follow the path, how we find the road to not creating suffering for ourselves. Just live. Okay, well, hopefully I haven't thoroughly obfuscated that. but that's what I have to say for today. Any questions?
I had a thought about one of the first things you said about wisdom having a soft heart. Because this week I read some dialogues with Plato, and I read The Trial and Death of Socrates, and I was just curious about it. I've never read anything about Greek philosophy much, and I found the depiction of Socrates to be so full of self and so obsessed with proving that he was smarter than other people, and he even says that it's his mission to keep asking people questions and challenging people who are supposed to be wise and to keep finding them unwise. And then he says that that's the reason why he's on trial and that's the reason why he's going to be put to death and all this. I don't even know if that has anything to do with the real Socrates. Obviously, there's no way to know really what these people were like, but it seems to have had great influence on a lot of people, and it was such a cold feeling that I got from it. And also, I don't want to judge Socrates really harshly, but it did seem to lack any kind of, any regard for the suffering being created for himself or other people.
Yeah, it reminds me of two things which could be said about wisdom. Come on, brain, you can do it. Mm-hmm. Well, first, we think of wisdom in the West as being the product of discriminatory analysis. We think of it as the product of logic. And we think about it as, in that regard, as we think about it, it's a cold process and has little to do with our heart and the reality of human life. But in Buddhism, wisdom is the ability to actually step beyond that, to be able to step beyond what is right and what is wrong, and to step into Buddha nature, which has as its characteristics compassion and love and wisdom. So part of what we're doing in practice is learning how to let go of our discriminatory judgment about life and step into a different place, a different way of being. And that different place, that different way of being, is deeply warm-hearted. Has a deep aspect of compassion about it, a deep aspect of love about it. It's selfless, and so in that respect has the quality of cold water oftentimes. I remember going to the Abbey, one of the first times I was at the Abbey, walking down the cloister, and having this feeling of like walking into a really deep, cold mountain spring. Just like, it's kind of scary, actually. What have I gotten myself into now? And in a way, the truth has a cold quality about it, but not in that analytical kind of cutting off sense. And we need to be able to recognize that and appreciate it. And the other part of it is that at no time does the experience of wisdom negate the consequences of karma. It's a famous kind of question in Zen. You know, there's a story about Hyakujo's fox. And the story in brief is that there's a teacher who's giving a lecture to a group of monks. He gets finished with the lecture and everybody leaves except for one monk who asks him, is it true that, let's go, when a Zen master realizes the truth, he's free from karmic consequence. And the teacher says, no, there's never a time when a teacher, when a person realizes enlightenment, is free from karmic consequence. And the monk says, thank you, because of what you've taught me, I've been set free. And leaves. And it turns out that the monk was born 500 times, was a teacher who taught that when a person realized the truth, they were free of karmic consequence. And because of that teaching, he was born 500 lifetimes as a fox. And this was the 500th lifetime, and as in his fox body, kind of turned himself into a monk and came and asked this question of Hyakutin. We think, and it is easy to think, that because we have penetrated through to where no self appears, that we are free of karmic consequence. But there is never a time when we are. And to me, you know, what you're talking about Socrates kind of goes to that very point. If you're always disrespectful of people, if you're always kind of trying to prove them wrong, if you're always being basically rude to them, it's no wonder that you're going to be on trial and get killed.
It doesn't make it fair either.
It doesn't make it fair. It doesn't make it right. Anything like that. Just, this is karmic consequence. So when I'm talking about my wretched, and you know, my 20-year wretched, we were talking about before the talk, I look at it and I think, okay, this is what I need to learn now. This is kind of one of these things that you see on the internet or in New Age dialogue. I just went through this because I needed to learn it. Well, okay, but the consequences of my needing to learn this are real. They affect me and they affect other people. There is karma consequence. And part of the reason that I can learn from it is that I'm left with a bitter feeling of being an idiot. That isn't going to go away. It's not going to go away because it's part of the consequence of my mistake. And so, and part of my training then is to, as deeply as I can, with as warm a heart as I can, accept that. Accept I have created suffering for myself. I have made these mistakes. I have affected other people. Look at that. Be there. Be in that place where that's true. And have that teach you something.